The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So here's my question. I have to say that of all the pieces of Pesach, of Passover, and especially all the pieces of the Seder, the one that troubles me the most is the Rasha, the wicked son, right? The Agada tells us there are four sons, Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah, right? There are four archetype educational models, four different educational paths, four types of children, right? And there are lots of different ways to look at this, and different allegories, different traditions. And one of them is called the Rasha. He's called the wicked son. And I got to tell you, that has always bothered me. How could you ever call a son a wicked son? Okay? Especially, by the way, when you take into account what it is that makes him wicked. Okay? If you take a close look at the Haggadah, right, at the Passover Haggadah, so it very clearly sort of states why this son is considered the wicked son, right? Because what does he say? He says, Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem? What is this to you? Right? Everybody still there? You still out there?
Yep.
Okay. I never know. You know, when you do these telecalls, you know, you could lose the call and talk for half an hour and then find out. Okay. So he says, Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem? What is this to you? Now, even assuming that line is said in some form of a cynical manner, and that's what really differentiates him from the Chacham, from the wise son, because the Chacham says, Ma ha'edot v'achokim v'mishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu etchem? What are all these laws that God commanded you? And the Rasha says, what is all this labor to you? So the rabbis say that the word etchem, which could also mean itchem, with you, is different from lachem, for you, not including me. All right, so this kid comes along and says, I don't get it. What is all this stuff to you? What's all this nonsense you're doing, right? So I have to tell you that as much as that's a challenging question, to call that son a wicked son, that's a very difficult thing to suggest. You know, some of you may know that we're, Bezrat Hashem, we're starting a one-year program in the fall, in Elul, and in September. And it's called a Raita, and it's basically a post-high school program for boys. And we're actually looking for the student that is uninspired and challenged and has really good questions that nobody seems to be able to answer. And if you really stop to think about it, by the Haggadah standard, this is the Rasha. I mean, imagine a mother comes to you and she says, I don't know what to do with my son. He sits at the Shabbos table, he says, what are you making Kiddush for? And he comes to synagogue on Yom Kippur and he says, what's all this fasting nonsense? Right, so imagine such a mother comes to you and it breaks your heart and she's having a hard time with her son and you say to her, oh, don't worry about it. Because Haggadah says your son's a Rasha. He's wicked. That's unbelievable. How could you call a son wicked? And then, what do you actually say to this son? Right? Ulufisha, right? He says, lachem velo lo. He somehow removes himself from the community. Ulufisha tzit atzmo min haklal. Since he removes himself from the general public, that's one way of understanding that phrase, klal, kafar b'ikar, he has denied the essence of Judaism. Now, you could have a whole discussion about the fact that the Haggadah is alluding here to what the ikar, what the essence, what the mainstay of Judaism really is. Notice it doesn't say Shabbat, it doesn't say Kashrut, it doesn't say how long your tzitzis are. It says if you remove yourself from the community, if you separate yourself, if you create separation, you've removed yourself, you're a Rasha. But that's very difficult. Because that would mean that the majority of the Jewish people today are wicked. They're Rasha'im. Because they've removed themselves to some degree from the cloud, from the general Jewish perception that the Haggadah seems to ascribe to. And then you go a stage further. The Haggadah continues and says, Va'afata hakeyet shinav. Now that's a difficult phrase, hakeyet shinav. Some people take that to mean set his teeth on edge, slam him, right? I mean, that's what you do. You have a kid, and he's having a tough time, and he's cynical. Hakeyat shinav, what does that mean? Lahakot shinav. Some people say that it's related to the word lahakot, to hit. There are many commentators who suggest that that cannot be. In fact, the Marsha goes so far as to suggest, I believe it was Marsha, based on the 8th chapter of the tractate of Sanhedrin, which describes the rebellious son, the Ben Sarur Moreh, that this can't be. It can't be that this is the rebellious son and that you slam him one. Because if he's under bar mitzvah, you can't call him a rasha. He's not yet responsible for his actions. You can't call him wicked. And if he's over bar mitzvah, the Talmud tells us you're not allowed to hit him, because that's called lifnei iver lo titein michshol. You're placing a stumbling block in front of the blind man. In other words, you're creating a scenario where he could do worse. He could come to hit you back. So therefore, you could never hit him if he's a rasha. So what does that mean, lahakot et shinav? So there's actually a verse in the book of Kohelet, which is, I think, Ecclesiastes in English. And in Kohelet, which is really King Solomon's philosophy of life to some degree, so the pasuk says, the verse says, if you have soldiers, okay, and the soldiers go to war, right? So the pasuk says, in kehaha barzel, this is in Perek Yud, pasuk Yud, right? The 10th verse of the 10th chapter of Kohelet, in kehaha barzel, okay, if the iron or the sword has been blunted or softened, for hu lo fanim kilkal v'chayalim yigaber, even with such a blunt-edged sword, a softened sword, the soldiers can still, right, even if an axe is blunt or you haven't honed the edge of the sword, it still strengthens the warriors. In other words, holding a sword still helps, even if it's a blunt-edged sword. Now that's a whole philosophical discussion, what that verse means, but the word keher therefore means to soften, to blunt. Now if you think about it, that makes a lot of sense. Because what does it mean, hakeya chinav, soften his teeth? When does a person's teeth become hard, right? When a person clenches his teeth, it's because he's angry. And I've always wondered if maybe what the Haggadah means here is if somebody could ask a cynical question like this, right? It's because there's anger. And anger always relates to pain, okay? This son is in pain. He's angry. And before you react to him, you have to soften his anger. You have to hear his anger, you have to receive his anger, you have to understand his anger, right? If a student is angry at why he's, forced to go to synagogue in the morning, he's right. Because the synagogue experience that he doesn't want to have isn't what the synagogue experience is supposed to be. And if you can't create an experience for a person that he wants to go to, I was talking recently with a student who's coming to a raita, and he was, next year. And he was telling me some of his hesitations and some of his excitements, and he said that, one of the questions that he had was about the organized prayer system, because he's never been able to get into an organized synagogue service. I don't know if anybody in the line has ever had that experience of waking up and going to synagogue and being in shul and just feeling like, what am I doing here, right? So I said to him, the truth is that at a raita, we don't have minyan in the morning, right? The boys live in the old city of Yerushalayim. If they want to have a minyan, if they want to daven, if they want to pray in the morning, they can go to 40 different places. They can go to the Kotel, they can go to the Or HaChaim synagogue, they can go to the Ramban synagogue, right? You don't have to do battle with somebody over prayer. So I said, but in the afternoon we do daven together, we do pray together, but it's an amazing experience because you go up on the roof of a 1,000-year-old Crusader building and you're overlooking Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, and on Har HaBayit in the Temple Mount, and the Judean desert is spread out before you, and you're overlooking Jerusalem, and somebody has a guitar as you lead into tefillah. How could that not be a meaningful experience? That's what tefillah should be. So if this boy, this second son in the Haggadah, is angry, maybe he's got a reason to be angry. And I can understand that you struggle with this question, you disagree with this question. How could you call him a Rasha? How could you call him a wicked son? There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that for sure we have discussed before. But the rabbis teach in Ethics of the Fathers, Hevedan kol adam lekavzchot, assume the best about every human being. Okay? Assume the best about every human being. So that's very easy to say. It's very hard to do. Right? You see me walking into McDonald's and getting a cheeseburger. You have to assume that I just discovered that I have a life-threatening disease, God forbid, that can only be cured by cheeseburgers. And you have to assume that when you see me going to get a cheeseburger, and let's say that on the way into McDonald's to get the cheeseburger, I pick up a lady of the night, a prostitute, on my arm. So you have to assume that she's a Jewish orphan girl. And it has to be so natural to you that when you see me do this, God forbid, so it's just, oh, he must be on the save a life. He's fulfilling the mitzvah of Ushmartem et Nafshotechem to save a life, and he found the Jewish orphan girl. So that's very easy to say. It's very hard to do. Most people, they're not capable of thinking on that level. But what does it say in the very next Mishnah, the very next teaching? It says, Harchek mishachen ra, distance yourself from an evil neighbor. So rabbis ask, how could you have an evil neighbor if you're judging every person meritoriously? This is the very next teaching. It's not off somewhere in the Jerusalem Talmud. The rabbis wanted you to see these things together. So Shimshon Feilhirsch suggests, the rabbis understood that there is evil in this world. Nobody expects you to open up a yeshiva in a crack house. But judge the action, not the person. Assume that a person is good. That doesn't mean that you have to accept his action as good. The action can be an evil action. And I think that that's a magnificent thought. And try to live your life by this thought until you get to the Haggadah. Comes along the Haggadah and says, no, he's a Rasha. So what makes somebody a Rasha? And how does the response, Ba'avur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeitim in Mitzrayim, when you finish doing whatever it is you do with his teeth, you say to him, it was because of all of this that God took me out of Egypt. Leave alo lo, me and not him. Now all of a sudden the Rasha is a him. If he would have been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. The wicked son wouldn't have been redeemed. What a terrible thing to say. You wouldn't have even gotten out of Egypt. So what is this all about? What's the message of the Rasha? Right? And so some rabbis like to say, well, at least the Rasha came to the Seder table. Not so simple if you read these four sons carefully. It doesn't say they're at the Seder table. It says you're having a dialogue with them. But okay. At least he's asking. At least you're in dialogue. So, what do you do with this? So there's an interesting discussion that also relates to the Exodus from Egypt, but on a slightly different topic that I think helps us to understand this question and really unlocks a major theme in Judaism and a significant piece of the entire festival of Pesach. Right? Today is Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Today is the new month of Nisan. And this is, you know, just when the moon is returning and we're rediscovering ourselves and we have the chance to change and renewal and rebirth. And this is the month which is the first month of the Jewish people, the Exodus, redemption, right? Powerful times. So when Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe gets down to Egypt, so you would imagine that Moshe would have had, expectations that things would go smooth. I mean, he argues with God for a week at the burning bush. You know, most people don't realize sort of the fine print of that story. It's all great, there's a bush, and the bush is not consumed, and it's burning, and he goes and take off his sandals. But then they get into this debate for a whole week. God says, I want you to go down and redeem the Jewish people. And Moshe says, who, me? Moshe says, I don't want to go. They're not going to listen to me, I'm a stutterer. You should go to Aaron. Aaron's been down there for 40 years, I'm uncomfortable, he's going to feel bad. Finally, God convinces him to go down. Which, of course, is an incredible discussion. Like, if God comes to you and says to you, go to Egypt, then you go to Egypt. That's unbelievable. But okay, so Moshe gets down to Egypt. So he would think, after that whole discussion, and God tells him this is going to work out, you're done. So he's going to walk in there, and the next morning, everybody's going to be out of Egypt. But of course, you know, we know, because we all saw the Prince of Egypt, right? It doesn't get better. It gets worse. Pharaoh gets so annoyed at these gruesome twosome Moshe and Aaron who are trying to get the Jews out of Egypt, he says, fine, not only am I not sending them out of Egypt, but from now on, the bricks that they make, I'm not going to give them straw to make bricks. They got to go collect their own straw. So things get worse. So Moshe must be tremendously disheartened. So he comes back to God. If you look at the very end of Perikei, of the fifth chapter of Exodus, Moshe comes, Vayashev El Hashem, he comes back to God, whatever that means, and he says, Lama hareot alam hazeh. Why did you make it bad for this people? V'lama zeh shlachtani? And why did you send me? In other words, you told me to come here, now you're making it worse? Why'd you send me? So it's very interesting that Rashi quotes the Midrash, he quotes the rabbinic legend, that there's something in what Moshe says that's problematic. Now mind you, this is Moses. This is Moshe Rabbeinu. Who are we to criticize Moshe? But the Torah wants us to see Moshe's flaws. So we have to, on the one hand, remember we're still talking about Moshe, who talked directly to God, and we don't really have the right. On the other hand, we have to take the right, because that's how we learn. Okay, so bearing that in mind, Moshe seems to come to God with a complaint. Now, if you're Moshe, if you're the greatest prophet that ever lived, you should not be complaining. So the Midrash, the rabbinic legend, says God's response to Moshe, when Moshe complains, is, Ata tireh, now you will see, Ata with an ayin, now you will see, Et asher aseh lefaro, that that I will do to Paro and to the Egyptians, and I'm going to take you out of Egypt. From now on, it's going to be smooth sailing, you're going to get out of Egypt. So Rashi quotes the Midrash that says, Ata tireh, now you will see what I do to Pharaoh. But you will not get to see what I do to the 31 kings of Canaan, of Canaan, because you're not going to get into Israel. What is that doing here? So the rabbis say that one of the things that Moshe said upset God, and that the beginning, the source of the consequence of which was Moshe not getting into Egypt, into Israel, begins with this complaint. In other words, there's something here that's problematic, something that somehow Moshe does that's not quite right. Now it's interesting, when you look at the Midrash, there are really two things here that Moshe says. Because on the one hand, Moshe says, Lama hareot alam hazeh? Why did you make it bad for the Jewish people? But he also says, Lama zeh shlachtani? Why did you send me? Now those are two lamas. So the rabbis point out that this may well be two different points. First of all, how could you make it bad for the Jewish people? And second of all, if you're going to make it bad for the Jewish people, why use me? Why send me? You know, if you're going to send me to make me a redeemer, nicht, but to send me, I mean, that's not fair. So the Midrash seems to suggest that one of these two things that Moshe said was a problem. But one of them was okay. Now, I would have thought that the sentence that was problematic is when Moshe says, Lama zeh shlachtani, why'd you send me? Because that would seem to be a little selfish. Like, at least don't involve me in this. But that Moshe says, Lama hareyot alama zeh, why'd you make it bad for the Jewish people? That's okay, because he's worried about the Jewish people. But in fact, Jewish tradition has it as the opposite. When Moshe says, Lama zeh shlachtani, that's okay, why'd you send me? He's right. What do you need to send me for? But when he says, Lama hareyot alam hazeh, why did you make it bad for the Jewish people? That's a problem. So I understand why the sentence of Lama hareyot alam hazeh, why did you make it bad for these people, is problematic. That I understand. Because who are you to question God? And how do you know what bad is? And if something comes from God, it must be good. I could understand, at least on a theological level. So we won't discuss that. What I don't understand, which I think will bring us back to our original question, what I don't understand is, why is it okay for Moshe to say, Lama zeh shlachtani, why did you send me? In other words, what's positive about that sentence? Why is it okay for Moshe to say, Lama zeh shlachtani, why did you send me? So Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl, the Rav of the Old City of Jerusalem, who has some incredible Torah anthologies called Sichot LeSefer Breshit, Sichot LeSefer Shmot, has an essay on this topic in which he suggests a magnificent response to this question. You want to know why it was not only okay for Moshe to say, Lama zeh shlachtani, why did you send me? But it was actually noteworthy. It was the proper response. It was worthy of emulation, right? Because what's really going on here? You see, the Gemara says, the Talmud tells us, right? It's impossible that the world won't have both bursi, which is the tanneries where they used to cut the hides, and that represents in Jewish tradition sort of the disgustingness of life, the part of life that's unpleasant, the wickedness in the world. Bosem is the sweet fragrance. The person who works in the spice factory. So the guy who works in the borsi, the tannery, he comes home, he smells disgusting. Nobody wants to go near him. But the guy who works in the bosem, everybody wants to sit with him because he smells wonderful. So the Gemara says, you can't have a world without both. You can't have a world without a Moshe, because the world would never have been redeemed. But you also can't have a world without a Haman, without a Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first temple, exiled the Jewish people to Babylon, and if that was God's will, then someone had to carry it out. So you need both. And make no mistake about it, they're both part of destiny and they both come from God. But the Gemara continues, Ashrei mi, praiseworthy is he who finds a way to be part of the bosem, to be part of the sweet fragrance. In other words, What's going to happen is going to happen, but you can decide whether you get to be the vehicle for good or the vehicle for bad. Oh, so now that's interesting. Right? Moshe is upset because Moshe doesn't want to be a vehicle for bad. Right? And by the way, this is a very significant question. Because at the end of the day, I always have to ask myself, you know, why am I here? What's the purpose of my being here? Person goes to sleep at night and has to ask himself, is the world better for my having been here? Person wakes up in the morning and asks himself, is the world going to be better because I'm here? Right? The fact that we woke up this morning, no matter how bad yesterday might have been, the fact that we woke up this morning means that Hashem still thinks that the world could be better because we're here. That's amazing. Right? And that's the question we have to ask ourselves every evening. Did the world get any better? And sometimes we mess up. Sometimes deep inside we know, you know what, the world isn't so much better because I was here today. But then comes tomorrow. Tomorrow is a whole new day, and that's amazing. And by the way, that's the message of Rosh Chodesh. The moon disappears, it gets dark, it looks so bad, and then it comes back. You can start all over again. Why did Moshe think that he was a vehicle for pain, a vehicle for suffering? Because he felt in his discussions with God about going to Egypt that if he came down as the Redeemer after having been out of Egypt for 40 years, when Aaron was down there sort of struggling, so then that's going to cause Aaron pain. And he didn't want to be a vehicle for bringing pain into the world. Now, of course, the problem with that is the whole Jewish people are waiting to be redeemed. So aren't the fact that the Jewish people need to be redeemed, isn't that more important than Aaron's pain? And yet no less than God himself, herself, itself, Hashem tells Moshe, right? Aaron is coming out to see you. And he'll see you. In other words, Hashem actually considers Moshe's point, a good enough point, to say to him, you don't have to worry. Aaron is not suffering. Aaron is such a pure person that he'll be so full of joy that you're coming to redeem the Jewish people, it won't occur to him to be jealous. That's the level of Aaron. But the fact that God has to answer that to Moshe means that Moshe has a good point. Now that's unbelievable. What do you mean that Aaron's going to suffer? 600,000 Jews are under the whip of Egypt. And you're worried about one, Aaron? So it could be, suggests Rav Nevinso, that what Moshe understands is that if God says that the Jewish people are going to be redeemed, then the Jewish people are going to be redeemed. And if they're meant to be redeemed on the 15th day of the month of Nisan, in the morning, then that's when they're getting out. It would have been so easy for a person in Moshe's position to think that he had something to do with the Jewish people getting out of Egypt. To think that the Jewish people need him for redemption. That it all depends on him. We get so stuck in our character role that we think it depends on us. Moshe understood, and that's the essence of anava, of humility. Moshe understood, believe me, the world will do fine without you. The graveyard is full of irreplaceable people. The Jewish people are going to be redeemed because it's time to be redeemed. Hashem says they're going to be redeemed. So the Jewish people are going to suffer one iota whether I go or I don't go. And if I don't go, someone else will go. But I have a responsibility to be sure that if I go, it's not causing pain. And therefore, if I could cause pain to someone, then I have to struggle with that role. Because that's part of my challenge in this world, to be a vehicle for good. In order for a person to have that perception, to recognize that he's meant to be a vehicle for good, he has to understand that he's part of a much larger picture, that he's part of a cloud. That there's a purpose to being in this world. There can't be a purpose to being in this world unless there's a creator of this world. Because ultimately, if there's no creator, we're all random, and any purpose that we ascribe to ourselves is subjective and random. But if Hashem created the world, if we're part of a bigger picture, if we're part of a larger story, then there's a purpose to everything that we do, and we have to struggle with what that purpose is. That's why Moshe was commended for saying, Lama ze shlachtani, because his job is to figure out not what God's plan is. His job is to figure out what's God's plan for Moshe. How am I supposed to fit into that plan? What am I supposed to do? And if I understand that I'm part of a bigger picture, then I understand that there's meaning to everything that I do. And that takes me in a logical direction. And that may well be the problem of the Rasha. L'fi she'otzi et atzmo min haklal. The Rasha, essentially, the essence of Rishut, of wickedness, is that you don't see yourself of a bigger picture. You don't see yourself as part of something bigger. It's all about you. It's all about self. And if you remove yourself from the bigger picture, which begins by removing oneself from the Jewish community or whatever community a person is a part of, but ultimately leads to the removal of oneself from the larger community, the klal, the source of all generality, which is Hashem. And that's the essence. And that's, by the way, the reason that we say to the Rasha, Ilu Hayasham lo hayanigal. If he would have been in Egypt, he wouldn't have been redeemed. That's true, because he wouldn't have been part of the community. The Jews that weren't part of the community, they never came out, because they weren't part of that bigger picture. And that's why it's so critical within the context of the Haggadah today that we become a part of that community, and one might suggest that the true response to the Rasha is to soften his teeth, to soften his anger, in order to allow him to become, to feel wanted by, and to return to being a part of that community. I wonder if that isn't the essence of what the Rasha is all about. There's obviously sort of a lot more to talk about, but that's at least a little bit of food for thought in preparation for the Haggadah and for the Seder evening. Let me unmute and we'll see if we can take a couple questions. Hang on 1 second. Okay, does anybody have a question?
Yes, I do. Put into practice what you're saying. How do you get the person to come to the table when they're so full of anger that they won't?
I'll tell you something. First of all, I really think that this is true. I think that, look, obviously every case is different, but I think that people very often feel judged. They feel, you know, we don't realize this, you know, a person gets more involved in Judaism as an example, right? I always tell this to students who go back from Israelite. You know, they've had this intense experience, they've been in Israel for 3 weeks, and they don't realize yet that they're in for some intense upheaval. This boy's going to come to Israel, and I imagine he's going to have an incredible experience. And you can't help, I mean, imagine you're sitting and learning Torah, you have to come back a different person, right? And you're in a different space, but your parents, they're more or less in the same space they were a year ago. So you come back, and all you want to do is share with them, but you don't realize the message that you give them. Because the fact that you've gotten more immersed and more involved and more excited about something sometimes sends a message that you have no intention of sending, you know? Which is the childhood that you gave me, the upbringing that you gave me, that's not good enough for me anymore. You don't mean to say that, but that's sometimes how people hear it. So sometimes the challenge is to put yourself in another person's shoes and to ask yourself, not what is it that I'm trying to say, but what do I think they're hearing? Number one. Number two, this may sound a little touchy-feely. It may sound a little schmaltzy, but I really believe this is true. You know? Deep down inside, okay? When someone struggles with these questions and they're angry at you, all you have to do is love them. And if they continue to be angry at you, then love them even more. And the bigger challenge, by the way, than loving a person is respecting them. Okay? More often than not, when you have these conflicts, it's because one person senses that another person doesn't respect them. Now, that takes work. It's not just a decision to pretend that you respect them. You have to really deep down respect them for who they are and what they bring to the table. And if you can't respect another human being for what they bring to the table, then you have no reason to expect that they're going to respect you. And I think when people begin to sense how much you do respect them, the walls come down, and they're able to hear where you're at. They may not agree with it, they may not embrace it, but they're at least able to receive it. So that's a little bit of food for thought. I'm not saying it isn't a lot of work, but it's work that's worthwhile. Another question. Anybody out there?
Two questions. What did you say was the Rosh?
So I said that the Rasha, the wickedness, is when a person chooses to remove himself from the community. The only person that the Haggadah seems to define as wicked is someone who refuses to be a part of the community. Now, by the way,
yeah.
If I'm right, okay, if I'm right, you could make a case for saying, and I'm not saying it's simple, this is not simple at all, but you could make a case for saying that if a Reformed Jew and a Conservative Jew and an Orthodox Jew all get together, right, and they want to create something together, and one of them isn't able to sit with the others, that individual becomes the Rasha. That's a very challenging idea for some people, but it's something to think about, right? You can disagree with someone after respecting them. If you first respect the person and then disagree with them, you haven't removed yourself from their community. You're dialoguing with them within the community. But if you disrespect them, then you're separating yourself from them. And that's rishut. That's wickedness. And by the way, if you look in the Netzivs, the Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin's introduction to the book of Breshit, within the context of this discussion, you will understand that that's exactly what he's saying Sinat Chinam is. Blind hatred which destroyed the temple is exactly that. Let's take one more question and then we have to get off. Anybody else?
If you respect them, that doesn't mean you go along with what they're saying. You can, they have
absolutely.
Like an opinion, but...
No, absolutely.
If you're...
Absolutely. You can respect someone, and then you can... You know what? I think I gave an example like this not long ago, but just to reiterate the point, I'll give you a good example, okay? Labels are very dangerous because they separate us and because we like to include whole groups of people in one label, and it doesn't work that way. But for the purpose of discussion, take, for example, the Reform Movement, okay? The Reform Movement began with a magnificent vision that after... hundreds of years of being separated and ghettoized in the world, that the world was finally opening their doors. They were willing to give us land rights and welcome us into the cities and accept us as equals and voting rights and suffrage. I mean, the industrialization and the Enlightenment, right? It's not accidental that the Reform Movement was born at the same time. And so the early thinkers of the Reform Movement said, now that they're willing to accept us, we've developed such a magnificent ethical system based on Torah, we should assimilate into the non-Jewish world so that we can teach them and bring them and share with them the ethics that we've developed. Right? Because we want to make the world a better place. Tikkun Olam. That happens to be a magnificent idea. It also happens to be completely mistaken, in my opinion. But that doesn't mean you don't respect where that idea comes from. That someone after 1800 years of exile and pogroms and massacres still cares enough about the world that they're willing to assimilate into the world, to share such beauty, that's a magnificent idea. That's why why the early Reform Movement took all mention of Israel out of their prayer books. They were vehemently against the birth of the State of Israel because they thought that that would just create another ghetto, and their whole goal was to assimilate and become one people, right? John Lennon's song, no heaven, no religion, no countries. That's why the early Reform Movement was vehemently against wearing any external symbolism of being Jewish, such as tzitzit and a kippah, because that would demonstrate that you were different, and we want to assimilate into the world. So you have to respect how beautiful an idea that is. Then you can vehemently disagree with it. And I personally disagree with it both because I think it's incorrect and because history has shown it's not true. But the difference between disagreeing with someone from respect and disagreeing with someone from disrespect is the difference between a dialogue and an argument. And I think that's all the difference. And we could spend a whole day seminar, you know, sort of going through texts and sources to demonstrate that this is so, but that's a longer discussion. Anyway, we are about to run out of time. I want to thank everybody for calling in. And I want to wish you all a wonderful, wonderful Pesach, Chag Kasher V'Sameach. And I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful Seder. And God willing, if all our prayers are answered, then we'll all meet back in Jerusalem for the first night of the Seder, and we'll all share our Paschal lambs together. But if not, bye-bye. I wish you well, wherever you are.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.